Welcome back, everybody. Welcome to Lecture 28 in this American History Program of History at Our House for the Junior and Senior High Class. Today's theme is Columbus Reveals a New World. So we're finally going to break out of this framework of thinking of the world in the Dark Ages, that where there really is only Europe, Africa, and Asia in the universe, and nobody else really clearly has any notion of anything else whatsoever. So we're going to get to a whole new world being revealed. Before we do that, I want to continue on with this mission of ours of fostering interconnection in our thinking. And I want to say two things about facts, practice, and the interconnection exercise. I guess let's start with the simple thing, which is facts practice. So if we go to the junior high or high school class webpage now, you'll notice that it says November is out there. So you can go to November, and a couple things will pop up once you get to the November webpage, assuming you don't have to wait as long as I'm waiting at this very moment. So let's just be patient as the server reveals the content. There we are. Okay, so November class webpage now has lecture 28, and it says week 10 class notes, so that's evidently last week's notes, with all the content about Greek geography, about Marco Polo, and about the early Portuguese efforts. And then you will also see the links to Facts Practice 1C and 1D. So this is what I would like to do tomorrow, just to keep you guys on your toes. I think this class might be down to doing facts practice in class for the time being just once a week, because I sense you guys are well off, and I don't want to bore you with an exercise that's kind of beneath you at this time. I really want to challenge you to go to take it to a new level. And that new level is not so much just jumping through hoops and regurgitating a bunch of facts. I think there's anything wrong with memorization. In fact, I'm a big advocate of memorization in history in its proper place, in the proper way. But that's just the thing, is what we're going to be talking about now is in its proper place and as part of the knowledge that you're trying to build. And in order to help you grow as a person who's more aware of the world and more capable of understanding this world, the thing that makes that possible is not just the basic who, what, where, when information, but the so what information and how does it all come together type of information and questions, which includes how did the world get to be the way it is today? Why did certain things happen? And then, of course, the so what question and all kinds of other interesting questions. And the way to prepare to think about those questions is to connect as much information up as possible, to create a knowledge web of your history knowledge. And so we've already started doing that. These green lines represent our so what questions, right? That we live in a globalized world, thanks to Christopher Columbus. We live in an America-centric world, thanks to the Founding Fathers. We live in a world, unfortunately, with certain kind of terrorism and war on that particular, on the people who are terrorists. We live in a world where Christianity is the dominant religion. We live in a world where people think about forms of government, such as democracy and republic, as the truth is much more valuable today, despite the fact that throughout most of history, monarchy has been the norm, and despite the fact that the Roman Republic and the Athenian forms of government fell and were destroyed, and people went back to monarchy in Europe, and we live in a European world, despite all that, we are here. It all comes together in a sum of all of these things. And so, last time I encouraged you to think about connections between, well, we've got the birth of Jesus and the fall of Rome. The connection there is an interesting one. It goes through the fall of Rome through to where we are today. So the connection there is, does anybody recall, or would you rather have me remind you? I know that one's a good one to challenge you on a Monday morning after you've been, after you're coming back from your overdose of candy. What's the, what's a good way of articulating this connection here, birth of Jesus to fall of Rome? This is a really great knowledge web element here. So this connection here, let me give you a hint, is birth of Jesus. Jesus was born and died in the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was the incubator of Christianity. It was this vast, ancient civilization. But then in 476, it's gone. Okay, Juliet, what can you make of that? What's the way to think of this here?
Well, Christianity outlived Rome.
Yeah.
Even though Rome is older, it outlived it.
There you go. There you go. That's the key thought. Jesus is born and died here in this Roman Empire. We would still be living in a Roman world if it were not for this. So we're not, but we are still living in a world with Christianity. So that's exactly the right thought, Juliet, is this set of links here is that Christianity outlived the Roman Empire. Christianity survived this trauma here of this civilization falling, and it became a component of European civilization, and so it's still here today. There you go. So it outlived it. Okay, then we got another interconnection between Athens and Rome and America. That one's easier, right, to articulate. It's just that we have a precedent. We have the thing that, we have these examples that the founders relied upon when making America. Okay, so I think the last time I promised that we would try to form interconnections involving mayonnaise. And they're not too hard to make, right? So I'm going to go ahead and see what we can do with that. Let's choose another color. Is it the colors? Okay, let's do purple for mayonnaise. And let's do a relatively easy one here. How thick is that going to be? Nice and thick. Okay. So let's connect mayonnaise. Oh, I don't want an arrow so much. We could have an arrow, but let's just have a regular line for interconnections. And maybe a little bit reduced thickness. Okay. All right, let's do this one. Okay, who's going to help me with that interconnection? I think that one is a pretty straightforward one, but what would you do with that one? I like it. I see hands coming up. Okay, Timothy, go ahead.
Mayonnaise Narmer, when he created monarchy, Mayonnaise Narmer created monarchy, and the whole reason, sorry, a fireplace is going on in the background, but Rome began as a precedent to that monarchy, but when it fell, people resorted back to monarchy because they had no idea what they were doing.
Okay. Whoa, slow down there. Okay, you said some really interesting things, Timothy, but every one of those needs to be sharpened up a little bit. So let me help you sharpen that, okay? One crucial thing is, Mayonnaise Narmer did not invent monarchy. We need a little bit of help there. How are we going to characterize that properly so that we don't get the wrong impression? Okay? Timothy needs a little bit of help to formulate that more correctly. Okay, Bria, can you help? How should we be thinking of that? Go ahead.
Set it as a standard norm.
I wouldn't say that either. So this is good. This is like trying to get the right title for a painting. This is like trying to have any clear thought. Okay, so what I would say, here's the way to think of Mayonnaise Narmer. Is Mayonnaise Narmer is the first example we have of anybody unifying a country in a historical context. So notice the way that I'm saying that. Okay, this is really crucial when you're studying history. He's the first example we have. What did I not say? What's the crucial thing that I'm saying there that's really important in terms of intellectual honesty and precision of thinking? Right, Juliet?
You said we have. You didn't say that he was the first one ever.
Yeah.
The first one that we know about.
Okay. Even more than that, Juliet, careful now. Even what I said was even more precise than that. I said, in a historical context. So in other words, what I'm trying to be very precise there is I'm trying to say, you can bet, you can take it to the bank, that before Manes and Narmer, there were monarchs. Right? It's not like human beings just start, like, it's happened right in 3000 BC. Somehow, somebody sprinkled some monarchy dust, and all of a sudden there's monarchy. You can bet that plenty of people have monarchy in all kinds of places in a prehistorical context. Because it makes the most sense. It's just this kind of primitive way of organizing life. So what we have to do is we have to precisely understand that what's happened is we've looked into the past, we've used this telescope of history to look as far back as we can, and the furthest back that we can see with any clarity, with what we would call historical precision, to be able to claim that we have some real knowledge. It might not be perfect and it might not even be certainty, but it's pretty strong knowledge that says there was a guy back there that did this. Okay, so it's what we know. It's what we can see from where we are. So that's really crucial, Timothy. To be able to formulate this correctly is Manes Narmer is the first example that we can see in a historical context of a person unifying a major nation state and forming a monarchy in order to rule that. Okay? I know that's really, you know, it's cutting things really thinly, right? But it's very important to say those things properly because he's not an inventor, Manes Narmer. He's just doing what people did. And so he's not creating something and he's not passing down some kind of great new thing to his descendants. So we want to characterize him properly. He just happens to be a historically significant character in that we can see him doing this. Okay? And then when we want to take that and we want to use that as a knowledge web, you said some other interesting things, Timothy. You said that, well, when Rome fell, the Europeans kind of went back to doing the same thing. That is very revealing that they went back to that model. Now, in fact, it was by that point, Rome also was a monarchy. So this is really deeply significant. In fact, we should draw a line here. Another line. We should draw a line here. Because this image here, I've included this map, which I think is a useful one to have on the timeline. There should be another line here. Because Rome was a republic when it became really historically significant. The first thing that the Romans did, basically, that where they show up in history, is they made a republic. So, congratulations. Awesome. But when you study ancient history, you learn that, well, you learn the theme, a republic if you can keep it. And were the Romans able to keep it? No. And the early story of Rome, what I find to be the most fascinating story of Rome is the improvements that were made to the republic and then the tragic disintegration of the republic. And so the whole early story of Rome, the whole reason to study it is to appreciate the theme. A republic if you can keep it. And the Romans couldn't. So if we're going to draw a line between Manes and the Romans, the line would be, they did their best, but it didn't work out. They couldn't keep a republic. It's not easy to do. And so by the time then the European barbarians come along, what could they possibly know of any progressive form of government? of any superior freedom-enhancing form of government. They didn't know that stuff. They were far from being capable of grasping that. So they went back to the standard. The only thing that people can do when they... It's such a kind of almost reflexive thing among human beings that when they're trying to sort things out, it's hard. Barbarians, you might even make the argument that barbarians need to be ruled. I'm not going to say that, but it's kind of an interesting challenge that human beings have just never seen any other way. And it takes them a long time to become civilized. Only civilized men can have freedom. I think that is a truth. You give freedom to the people of Iraq and they're gonna ruin it. They're gonna wreck it, which is what's happening now. They're not ready. They got a lot of growing up to do. You give it to the people of Afghanistan, and America tried that too. It's not gonna work there either. It's freedom is really difficult, and the Romans weren't able to do it, and so the European barbarians certainly weren't. So this is powerful stuff. These integrations here. Manes Narmer is he's the example. He's the precedent. He's the guy who stands out as, see, ever since then, this is what we've been doing. And only when we get civilized are we worthy of freedom. It's not easy to do. And there's plenty of barbarians out there. Right here they are. There's plenty of barbarians out there. The people who want to destroy America, they're not interested in creating a new kind of freedom. They're interested in creating... There we go. Here's interconnection. The people who destroyed the World Trade Center. What kind of society do they want to create? Why do they hate America, and what would they like to have instead? Final interconnection for today. But very worthy. Yeah, they do want to create a monarchy. Does anybody know what that's called? In the history of Islam, there's only monarchy. Just like everywhere else. Keen?
Their sort of monarchy is the caliphate.
A caliphate. So, right. Muhammad was succeeded by men known as the caliphs. And they were the rulers of the Islamic Empire. The caliphate. And so what do you see? Those awful, awful people right now today, they're called ISIS, right? And they're posting YouTube videos, cutting the heads off of people. So you can tell this is barbarians, right? The barbarians are back. Well, they've never gone away. They're just in different places and different times. And the barbarians are still around. And what do they want? They want to create the caliphate, and they say it out loud. How on earth they think they're going to figure, to do that? I mean, it's crazy, but it's shocking and it's disturbing, isn't it? That in a time as advanced as we have become, and as amazing as the world is, that there are still people who can't grasp it, who are blind to all the wonders of modern life, and who still want to go back and create basically a Dark Ages caliphate, a Dark Ages monarchy again. They want to take airplanes, and instead of using them to fly around the world and travel and trade and create wonderful relationships between people, they fly them into buildings and kill people. Barbarians. So there's interconnection for you. So, history is full of patterns. It's full of kind of certain constants and things repeating kind of cycles and stuff like that. There's a lot of stuff to recognize here. And so even the most distant events we can line up, we can see that there's common denominators. They go together. All right, so that's a pretty good... I think that's enough of interconnection for today, even though it's my one of my favorite ways to approach history here. This is our current knowledge web. Today we need to talk about Christopher Columbus. We're going to run out of time if I don't stop on this theme. So let's get back to the world before Christopher Columbus here. And the best way to illustrate that, not that one just quite yet. The best way to illustrate that is the Frau Moro map of 1455. I think this is a perfect way to illustrate the world before Christopher Columbus, because what we have here is a world that is still so profoundly unknown to the people living on it. Right? They don't know the world they live in. They're stuck in little pockets of isolated humanity. And right now, as this map is being made, the Hundred Years' War has just ended, right? This little pocket of humanity over here has just, failed to conquer this pocket of humanity over here, and now they're worst enemies forever. And over here, we got another pocket of humanity, and people there are fighting each other as well, and they're totally absorbed in their own affairs, and so on and so forth, everywhere you look. And nobody really has a clue about this world. This is the best that the most brilliant geographer that Europe had to offer. And it turns out it's 1459. Maybe I'm getting my dates a little wrong here. 1459, the best geographer in the world, this is the best he could do. So we're still in a world of ignorance, right? We're still in a dark age. It's when human beings don't even know where they are. So we're waiting for somebody to come along and shine some light in on this, and revive this sense of knowing and this desire to know, this thrill of inquiry into the world and discovery. And we are finally going to get it. Now, Prince Henry got us started, so he's a deserving, character of recognition in our story of the Age of Discovery. He got the story going. He was very much a man of his time, and he's involved in conquests and all kinds of regular stuff that people were doing in the Dark Ages. But he starts in on exploration and takes the Portuguese to about, here. If we're starting in Portugal, and along comes Prince Henry, and they conquer Ceuta, and he says, well, now we got to go here. And every year they go a little bit further, and by 1455, 1445, sorry, he's taken them to there. And then by 1455, around the time of his death, the Portuguese have gotten to the Gulf of Guinea. So, pretty good. And I think that if we're looking at the Frau Moro map, it's kind of interesting because it might be, where's the Frau Moro map? Oh, wrong one. My sense of it is the Frau Moro map here is that, we're talking approximately, oh wait, I want to annotate in a different way. Talking approximately of something like this. Leaving Portugal and going... Oh, that's the wrong color. That's a bad color for this map. Okay, just a sec. Stop annotating. Annotation tools are so clunky. I wanted red. Okay, so over here, we're leaving Portugal and we're going around the Cape of Good Hope, probably there, as far as they're thinking. And I think they're going into the Gulf of Guinea, and they're thinking it's something like this. And they've got mixed reports about what's going to happen once they get there. We're going to take it back to the real map in just a second, because I think that what we have on our real map is right here. You're going to see lines kind of crisscrossing inside of the continent. And I'm going to take you back to the real map for a second. And just keep that in mind as we go back. And you'll see that by 1480, the Portuguese had discovered the mouth of the Congo, which is a very interesting river. I don't know if it's possible to navigate all the way up to, I think Lake Victoria is the name of it, but it might be. So the Portuguese were interested in that because they thought of it as a possible shortcut. Maybe you don't have to go all the way around the continent. Right? So they were quite absorbed by all of this, and it took them a long time to figure out the best route. And meanwhile, along comes Christopher Columbus. So the Portuguese are torturously working their way down the coast of Africa. They're doing a heck of a job, and it's hard to do because they've got a lot of ignorance and prejudice and other things to get over. As Alexander was noting back then, there was, for instance, the myth that at the equator, it was so hot that the water boiled. And all kinds of other things, sea monsters, and there'd be, sailors had visions of falling off the earth and stuff like that. I mean, there was such a wide variety of ways of filling in for ignorance, right? What happens? What happens when people don't know? Right? When you are, if you think about it, it's like when you're a little kid and you're afraid of the dark. What happens? Your mind fills in the blanks, right? And it starts to create a lot of imagery based on who you are and what you know of the world. And it's just like that for primitive people. So they had all kinds of stories and tales, and sometimes there might be a legend from ancient times, all kinds of stuff. The thing is, nobody knew. Nobody knew. This was knowledge as far as it had stretched. So the answer is, the truth is, about the world, nobody knew. And the only way to know was to go. I like that. The only way to know was to go. I always like it when I happen onto catchy formulations. The only way to know was to go. And this is what is so important about Columbus. People will argue ad nauseum. Do you guys know that expression? It's a good... guess what language it's from. Chat. Ad nauseum. We have lots of expressions in our language from Latin. I believe that's how it's spelled. Ad nauseum. It's like the word nausea, right? It means until you're dizzy, right? Until you're sick. People will argue ad nauseum about the minutiae of the story of Columbus. Well beyond what the actual evidence that we know and that we have allows. So some people just can't get enough of figuring out exactly what might have happened on a particular day at a particular time, and so on and so forth. And so that stuff will never end. But the key, the real importance of Columbus doesn't lie in any of those, in any of those things. It lies in the fact that we are looking right here at the world as it was known. And it lies in the fact that the only way that human beings were going to push back this boundary here, this boundary, which in some interpretations is where you're going to fall off the earth. This boundary, to some people, not to all, and I'm not saying to whom and to what, because I'm not going to presume to tell you who it was that believed one thing or another, because there's no way to know. But to a lot of people, in fact, that was the world was a disc. It was a flat disc. And if you went to the edge, you'd fall off. Didn't know how big the disc was, but they had all kinds of versions of the story. And because to a lot of people, the idea that the earth was round was just a curiosity and kind of a freakish notion. This is a funny manuscript from the Dark Ages where somebody talks about the theory of a spherical earth. right? And here's a diagram, and he's saying, okay, if we got a spherical Earth, then this guy starts walking that way, and his buddy, who's facing the other way, starts walking that way. And if they keep going, well, this is exactly the truth, right? Technically, if it was possible. If they keep going, then they're going to end up meeting each other on the opposite side of the Earth. And people had a lot of trouble wrapping their minds around this thought. Because when you look at this, and there were serious discussions of this, you know, when you look at this, what's the problem with this? What's wrong with this picture of the notion that the Earth is a sphere? Are you kidding me, Alexander?
People are upside down.
The people are upside down. Nobody can live there. The blood will go to your head. Well, actually, you'll fall off, right? So, I mean, there was no theory of gravitation until Isaac Newton. I mean, it was an observable fact, but there was no way of kind of grasping. How is it possible that objects coalesce in some strange and mysterious way together and they stick together and planets have gravitational power and you can be on the other side of the Earth and the blood doesn't go to your head and you don't fall off the planet and it feels just as normal to you as the person on the other side? They argued and argued in the Dark Ages. Anybody who even thought of this question argued about this, but again, how could you know? This is all fun and games, is what this is, these diagrams. And it's just fun and games. How could you know? The only way to know was to go. And so that's why Columbus matters so much, because he enters the scene, and the Portuguese are trying to push the boundaries of knowledge. They're trying to get past all of the superstitions, and they're really struggling to do it. Eventually, they're going to make it to the tip of Africa. But meanwhile, there's so much more to know. And here's this guy named Christopher Columbus, and he's spent his whole life as a mariner. So here he is. Here's the early voyages of Christopher Columbus. So he's born in Genoa. And as a youth, he is plying these Genoese trading routes in the Mediterranean. So he's seen everything there is to see around here. And then he is shipwrecked in Portugal and joins his brother there and becomes a map maker. This is a very significant time in his young life because he learns the art of map making. And the people of Europe are developing the art of map making. And if when I say developing, I mean developing. Here's the best map that the Europeans had of the Mediterranean Sea in the time of Marco Polo. It's called the Carta Pisana. And it doesn't look like much, does it? But it's pretty impressive in certain ways. It's called a Portolan chart. And you can glean the way that it works by looking here. Okay? That's Italy. And there's Sardinia. There's Corsica. This is the coast, and it takes you down to Iberia. Right? This is northern Africa. And along every coast, you see lots of lines. And those are just annotations. Those are the indications of where the harbors are, where the ports are, where everything is on the coast. And these Portolan charts are really interesting because what they did was the navigators would leave one place and they would literally go in one direction and say how long did it take and estimate how far away that was, and then you would know this is one spot and this is another spot and this is how long it takes and this is how big the sea is. And so on and so forth. And this was collected over decades and centuries of learning and learning and learning and tirelessly putting this together. And these charts were state secrets. I mean, they were extremely valuable. And they weren't shared because because they were your advantage. If you were the ruler of Venice and your merchants possessed the most accurate chart possible, then you had an advantage over the people of Genoa or the people of some other city, right? And so the knowledge didn't grow very much, but eventually it did. And this is a similar chart more than 200 years later, which kind of shows us, you know, the state of the art, right? It's gradually we're getting the ability, the understanding, the ability and the knowledge and all that collected together to depict the surface of the earth on a certain scale. We're getting there, aren't we? It's still not right. In a sense, right? If we apply a modern standard, it's still not quite there. But you'd sure rather have this map than the one we were just looking at, right? It's pretty useful for certain purposes, right? And you've got the directions that will take you from one place to another on a certain azimuth, using a certain compass bearing from southern Italy. You know how to get across here, so on and so forth. So that's the whole point of the lines and that symbolize these different ways that you can sail around, and how you get from one place to another. So Columbus worked on these types of problems. He became a cartographer. He became a cartographer and an explorer, and not so much an explorer, but a mariner. Good general term there. So on Portuguese ships, he applied these routes as well, down to the coast of Africa and all the way up to Iceland. So basically, by the time he had matured and was a seasoned sailor, he knew what Europeans knew. In a real sense, he knew what they knew already. I mean, as far as they had gotten, he had been. These were the limits of knowledge. Except that the most advanced science that the Europeans had suggested something quite exciting. With the rebirth of Greek geography and a certain intoxicating premise started to become active in people's thinking about the world. So here we have this Italian geographer named Toscanelli in 1474 making a map. The map is only the orange part, by the way. What's this light blue stuff? What's the purpose of this map, which I really love this map? What does it do for us, Alexander?
It shows us where the stuff actually is as opposed to where he thought it is.
Exactly. Right, exactly. So it gives us a real sense of what Columbus thought he was doing and then what he ended up doing, right? So Columbus has got this thought. He's got this vision of the world. The vision is this. I'm going to leave from over here. Right? And I'm going to go, because he's sailing for Spain, so I'm going to leave from here. And go down to these islands. These are the Canary Islands. They belong to Spain. And then I'm going to go over here. Now, why am I going to go straight west? There's these legends that there might be this island over here called Antilia. So maybe there's a nice waypoint, you know, kind of halfway across. And then I'm going to keep going. And the next thing that I will run into is Cipangu. Which is what? what's Cipangu really, Ben?
Japan,
right? Off the coast of Cathay, which is the ultimate destination because that's where Marco Polo went. Cathay, in other words, China. So in Columbus's conception of the world, and there was no way to know except to go, right? And his conception of the world, based on the model of the world that he had, which nobody could say was right or wrong, nobody had a basis for saying was right or wrong, this was how it might work. Was this not worth trying? Was this not an exciting prospect? Would this not possibly bring a whole new way of understanding the world and complete this understanding of what the world is and how we can live in it? If we could accomplish this, wouldn't that be amazing? And nobody was willing to do it. Took him ages to convince anybody to allow him to even try. And so he worked on that problem for years. I don't know if it's decades, but for an endless amount of time in his life, for sure. And Timothy, go ahead.
Is Antillia a real island?
No, no. Everything in Orange is make-believe, except, of course, I mean, the European coast over here is real. But even this is not true, right? There's the Azores here that belong in Portugal, but even this is not really well mapped. No, so it doesn't exist. I mean, there is Bermuda right over here, but that's nothing compared to Antillia, as imagined by Columbus. So no, that doesn't exist. So, I mean, that's one thing that made it hard for Columbus was as he sets out on his voyage, it's not there. And so this is my map of Christopher Columbus's first voyage as he's going across the Canaries, across this empty ocean for 5 weeks in a row, straight across, right? I'm trying to have the curvature of the earth built in here to kind of give us the sense of we're going to fall off the planet any second. And he's going and going and going and finally he gets over to, I mean, this is where Antillia is supposed to be. So, There were a couple weeks there where the men were just gonna revolt and go back. And it was very hard to keep them going, and Columbus even played tricks on them, and changed his logs and lied to them about how far they had come because he wouldn't be able to get them to keep going, because they just just didn't want to go that far. It was scary. For all kinds of reasons. Basically, they were going into the unknown. And to go out into the unknown, you gotta be a certain kind of person, right? You gotta be the kind of person who's willing to be first. To do something that no one else has ever done. It takes an enormous amount of courage. And especially when it's on the premise of your own conception of the world and that nobody else, you've been arguing with people for years and decades about this and nobody accepts what you have to say. And you're the only one. I mean, this is an amazing degree of independence that Columbus had to have. Willingness to trust his own mind and to do things on his own conscience and understanding of the world. And of course, in the end, he wasn't so much proved right, except that in one sense he was, that when you go west, you do get somewhere. You don't fall off. You don't run into sea monsters. I mean, there might have been some pretty neat sea monsters, but some neat whales and stuff. But the water doesn't boil, and so on and so forth. But you don't get to Asia. You don't, because Toscanelli and all the greatest geographers of the time, and we can't. You know, it's tempting to make fun of them a little bit because they were so wrong. But the thing is, you could not know. There was no way to know without going. You couldn't know until you... What did I say? Oh, I lost my formulation. So, yeah. Anyway, chatted to me there, King. You couldn't know until you go. Something like that. So Columbus ends up instead in the Bahamas. It's very disappointing. The people there are nothing like the ones that he was hoping to meet. They aren't any kind of well-known. They're not the Japanese and they're not the Chinese. They are what Europeans called the Indians, right? The people of the Indies. They thought that they were... possibly in the islands next to Japan, right? All these islands in orange here, these are the Indies. And so we're talking like Indonesia and the Philippines and all of those islands that are there, but weren't clearly known. So Columbus thought he might be somewhere in that region. So we're talking about the Indians here, even though we're not going to use that term anymore. People are not used to using that term anymore. And so, Columbus is really disappointed that they are nowhere near the impressive people he was expecting to find. So given that they were primitive barbarians, he did what he was supposed to do, and this was his job, and we saw the painting. He claimed it. He claimed the new land on behalf of Spain. There was no legitimate reason in his eyes or anybody's eyes in that time to do otherwise. In no sense would anybody back then have supposed that anything belonged to people like this. I mean, they were hardly more advanced than animals. They were running around naked. They were people. They were people. And we are going to, you know, kind of tackle this question as to, and people today, you know, continue to struggle with this question about what they, what should have happened versus what did, and what might have happened, and so on and so forth, and whether or not there, these more advanced people from Europe should have acted differently, and so on. That I think is not the most essential question. And we'll talk about that anyway tomorrow and the day after. But he claimed it for Spain, and then they sailed around for a while in that area, and a bunch of things happened that are a little controversial. There are different versions of the story. There's no way to know whose version was exactly true. So we'll try to stick with kind of the most basic stuff, which includes that, you know, a settlement was left behind on this island of Hispaniola. The settlement was called La Navidad, and we'll talk about that. And Columbus returned with two of the three ships that he had sailed out on and made his way back to Europe and got back, was successful in returning with a whole bunch of exotic stuff. We'll talk about that, and impressed people enough that he was allowed to go back. And then begin all of the difficulties that attend to basically living in a civilization that is mostly barbaric, that has certain civilized elements, but is mostly barbaric, and encountering people who are absolutely primitive barbarians, and all of that starts to unfold in a rather unpleasant way. But basically, most significantly for us living here and now, we have the people in the world who are at least starting to revive that element of their civilized selves that the Athenians and the Romans had first given birth to. They're starting to rise up back to that standard, and they're the ones who are going to come across to America. And we should be very, very thankful for that. Thanksgiving is an entirely appropriate way to think of the discovery and colonization of America, in the sense that we should give thanks for the fact that Columbus was so brave, and the colonists who came here were so brave, and were so industrious and so hardworking and so determined to bring European civilization over here, because we're living in it. So that is the ultimate long-range view of what was going on. We'll look at some of the details and the minutiae over the next couple days, but we always need to keep our focus on the long term, and the ultimate meaning of it, the full context, is that we live in a globalized America-centric world, and isn't that amazing and wonderful and true and good? So, all right, we'll come back to this and challenge ourselves to see what else Christopher Columbus was up to, and what else the Europeans were up to, and onward into a world revealed to human beings as they have never known it before. We're going to go from this hint of a new world that Columbus first is granting to us to a really rapidly expanding understanding. Thanks to Columbus and others, we're going to get really quickly, by historical standards, to quite a complete understanding of the geography of the major continents in the world. This is going to be a radical change for European civilization. It's going to have all kinds of new avenues to expand out into and it's going to do it. So we're getting there. We're getting to the world that we live in. Alrighty. That'll do it for today. Don't forget Facts Practice 1C. We will indeed do it tomorrow and try to focus in on a little bit more interconnection to get you ready for writing very soon. Thank you, folks. That's it for today. Bye for now.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.